to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 38, The Battle of Sullivan's Island. Aboard the HMS Bristol, the exiled South Carolina governor, Lord William Campbell, watched as the British fleet sailed for Charleston. Campbell was instrumental in getting a fleet sent from England in the first place. While in London, he met with the king. He explained that a demonstration of force would solidify Tory resolve, and those southern loyalists could be now enlisted to support the king. With that support, they would be able to bring the south back under control of the crown. So under the command of Admiral Peter Parker, a British fleet sailed from Ireland in late March. They arrived at Cape Fear in May, rendezvousing with Clinton's fleet. From there, they set sail for Charleston. Clinton, by this point, I'm sure, is very confused and angry about the turn of events in the South. It was made clear to him that by the governors of the South, the royal governors of the South, that if they just showed up, Southern loyalists would come in droves to support the king. But in Savannah, he's turned back. The Patriots get cannons on the high ground, threaten to bombard his ships. They even send fire ships downriver to turn him away. And in North Carolina, 1,600 loyalists were coming to support Clinton, and they're stopped before they can rendezvous with him at Wilmington. So, in two separate tries to break into the South, Clinton is basically turned away. So the combined British fleet heads for Charleston, South Carolina. It's definitely a large port, probably the largest in the South in colonial America, also one of the South's largest cities. If they could take the port and take the city, they would have a nice foothold to start moving troops into the South and eventually march them north to relieve Canada and Boston. Now, there isn't a very large force of Continental Army there, maybe a couple of thousand men. They do have Charles Lee. He's sent south at this point to kind of rally the South, give them a strong commander, and hopefully he can stop Clinton from invading. At least that's the thought process. Charleston is also protected by natural features. The first is that it's set back in a bay. It's not actually on the Atlantic Ocean, so the British fleet would actually have to sail into the bay. And to do that, you would have to sail past two islands, James and Sullivan. The only way to approach the city was to pass between the two islands. The approach is difficult. There's a sandbar that runs in between called the Middle Ground, and it's very tight to James Island and very difficult to navigate. So your best bet is to go to the left side of the Middle Ground if you're approaching it, but that brings you very close to Sullivan Island. It's there that the Patriots have built a palmetto, wood, and sand fort and named it, conveniently, Fort Sullivan. Fort Sullivan has 31 guns and was manned by 435 men under the command of Colonel William Moultrie. Moultrie was born and raised in Charleston. He planned to become a planter, but decided to become a soldier instead. Lucky for us. He sides with the Patriots with the onset of hostilities in 1775. He is commissioned a colonel of the 2nd South Carolina. I know that I've mentioned it before, but I just want to bring to the point that the American Revolution is almost like our first Civil War. Families don't always agree, should we be loyalist, should we be patriot? And that's what happens with the Moultrie family. Whereas Moultrie becomes a colonel in the Continental Army, his brother stays loyal and actually becomes the lieutenant governor of British East Florida. So, little side note. Lee wasn't a huge fan of Moultrie manning the fort. The fort is unfinished. In his mind, if the British attack, it's very easy for them to get around the fort and to surprise Moultrie from the rear. All they have to do is get past the guns. So it's not that Lee's concerns are totally out of place. But John Rutledge, the president of the General Assembly and the leader of the South Carolina Continental Government, tells Moultrie to stay. So Moultrie stays. And I think he does because he understands that Fort Sullivan is vital. It's the fort that defends the entrance into Charleston Bay. It's basically the best protection the city has. If they can't get boats in, they can't land troops. And the British know that too. They know that they can't take the city without first taking the fort. So opposing Moultrie would be the combined force of Henry Clinton's 2,000 troops and the 260 guns of the Royal Navy under Admiral Peter Parker. One weapon that the British didn't account for was the weather. The weather around that area is definitely temperamental, we'll say. And with adverse winds, they kept the British fleet a few miles offshore. They couldn't get in close. So Clinton took his time, and he decides to recon the fort. He's looking for weaknesses, and he's looking for areas to land troops that he could best approach the fort. Clinton's sailing around Sullivan Island in a sloop, notices that the fort is incomplete. If he lands his troops on Long Island, which is directly behind Sullivan's Island, then they could ford the narrow channel between the two islands at low tide. Then all they would have to do is brush aside some militia and take the fort from the rear. It's a great plan. Charles Lee, who's currently bracing for the British attack on the city itself, notices that Moultrie's troops are totally exposed out there, and if they need to retreat, they need to find a way that they can quickly get back to the city. So he's trying to build a pontoon bridge just in case Moultrie needed to make a fast exit. So Clinton makes the first move. Now the big warships are still stuck out to sea, but the troop transports, well, they're smaller boats, and they're able to maneuver a little bit better. So they maneuver into Long Island on June 16th. Clinton lands 2,200 men on Long Island and marches directly across to the channel. When he arrives, to his horror, he finds that even at low tide, there's no way it can be forded. The British were not going to be able to make a ground attack. So it would fall to Parker and the Navy to take the fort. Clinton got his troops back on their transports and they rejoined the fleet. The weather finally cooperated, and Parker's warship sailed into position on June 28th. Yes, a full 12 days later. So Parker lined up 8 warships for a broadside. At noon, over 100 guns opened up on the fort. Those are staggering numbers. That would be enough to turn any fort into Swiss cheese. But it doesn't. You see, the fort's materials are what made it so strong. Palmetto wood is a spongy wood, so when the cannonball hits it, even with all that force behind it, it actually just gets stuck in the wood. And though the fort was mostly made out of palmetto wood, they used sand in places to create bankments or probably to close gaps between the wood itself. And the sand acts as a shock absorber. So this thing was beyond strong because not only could the cannonballs not puncture the wood, but even the vibrations of the blasts or the constant pounding of heavy guns wouldn't rattle the wood loose because the sand actually acted as a shock absorber. So it's actually a brilliantly built fort. And it shows you that Parker really overestimates the Continentals. He uses brute force to try and get the fort to surrender. And that's going to work against him. You see, he had a 9th ship. This one was the HMS Thunder. It's about a mile offshore because it mounted a 10-inch mortar. So the mortar, as we talked about when we talked artillery, is going to fire a high arc shot. And hopefully you land the shot inside the fort, causes all kinds of destruction and mayhem. This is a brilliant idea. Except the HMS Thunder is over a mile away. That's a pretty grand distance to lob a mortar shell. So, thinking outside the box, the crew of the mortar packs extra powder. Extra powder, extra distance. That's actually really smart. Except mortars don't work like cannons, where cannons roll backwards because the force of the projectile being fired out of it is linear. So all that force pushes the gun back. A mortar is different. It has a vertical trajectory. So the shot goes up. So all that force behind the mortar shell being pushed out of the mortar pushes all that pressure down. So because they put so much powder into this mortar, they actually cracked the deck of the ship. The recoil was so great that the HMS Thunder took itself out of the fight. So Parker is back to 8 ships. The British aren't doing a lot of damage to the front of the fort. But if they could get to the side or even the rear, they could fire directly down the firing line. So Parker sends the Actaeon, the Siren, and the Sphinx. He's going to try and end around with them. Problem was, is they went towards the middle ground, and they went way too wide. All 3 ships get stuck on the sandbar. The Sphinx and the Siren will eventually free themselves, but the Actaeon can't. It's stuck. So it hasn't been very long into this fight, and Parker has lost 4 of his 9 ships. His only choice is to pound the fort into submission. Except the fort is taking abuse and nothing's happening. The one disadvantage I will say Moultrie did have, he didn't have a lot of powder. But, once again, our favorite crafty patriots find a way to take their weakness and turn it into a strength. Keeping up a hot, heavy fire is going to expel your powder rather quickly. So Moultrie has his men take aim shots. Now, this is not always common in at least revolutionary warfare. It's more of this barrage fire mentality. Yeah, you're aiming at a target, but because of the way cannonballs fly or the way troops are laid out, you don't have to aim at a particular target. So you're not always as careful as where you're aiming. And you're just firing in a general direction at a general distance, and something's going to get hit because, well, the way the troops are laid out, they're all grouped together. And when you're in naval warfare, you're usually rather close to each other because you start with shooting at each other, then you get in close, you shoot at each other some more, and then you board each other, you start fighting hand-to-hand, and then eventually someone wins. So Moultrie totally breaks with the norm and has his men take aim shots. And they inflict a lot more damage on the British fleet than the British fleet inflicted on Fort Sullivan. They actually took particular aim at the HMS Bristol, Parker's flagship. One shot in particular hit the ship, sending a splinter into the side of the exiled Governor Campbell that eventually killed him. Kind of funny twist of fate there. So the battle continued. It was a continuous back and forth, the British shelling the fort sending shots at the British, and this continued until dark. Neither side could see each other, and the British had to get together and figure out, well, what the heck are we going to do? The British had suffered 64 dead and several hundred more wounded. A lot of these men were on the Bristol, which was hit over 70 times. So it becomes pretty clear that they're not going to raise the fort. So the British are going to have to cut their losses and leave Charleston. The Patriot side, of the 7,000 cannonballs that are fired at the fort, they lost 12 men with 25 more wounded. Yes, a grand total of 37 casualties. That is unreal. Just before midnight, the fleet sails north, and the Patriots burn the Actaeon. This was a stunning victory for the Patriots, and probably one of the best victories of the early part of the war. I mean, you thought Concord was good. Bunker Hill, well, you technically won, but didn't win. We did have that fun little side talk we had about the Margaretta up in Maine. That was a lot of fun. But so far, everything's been mired with defeats. Canada has just been a disaster. We're going to head into New York, which, spoiler alert, if you don't know your history, New York campaign is a disaster. So Fort Sullivan is the shining light of 1776 as far as battles go, because it's definitely a great victory for the Patriots. The British won't try to invade the South for another 4 years. Fort Sullivan will stay intact and will later on become Fort Moultrie, for those who are Civil War buffs, because it is renamed for the colonel that defended it. So that's going to do it for this week. These 2 episodes were a little short, and that's okay. I didn't realize how short last week's episode was. I thought it was kind of funny. I was like, oh my gosh, it's 11 minutes. And I was thought I was talking a lot, but I guess I wasn't. But these were two little anecdotal stories that I wanted to bring out because, well, they're just fun. And they're, you know, good, solid, lighthearted victories because when we get into the New York campaign, it is going to get a little depressing for the Patriots. So I thought I would bring a high point to it. So the plan for next week is we are going to head back north and we're going to talk about a piece of paper that became, well, just a little bit important. I'm going to leave off it this week with an apology. One, for the poor sound quality. That's not my computer. That's me. There is this weird crackling coming in over my microphone that I just simply can't figure out. But besides that, I spent all of last weekend sick with the flu, at least up until yesterday. It's started to get a little better, so that's good. But be on the lookout because the flu is definitely rampant this season. I just want to remind everyone that, of course, the Facebook is always there. So if you have any questions, you can always shoot me a message. Or anytime I put up books that I'm recommending, there actually aren't a lot of good book recommendations for this early part of the Southern campaign. They're kind of just footnoted when you talk about the more bigger, wow, that was really poor English, I'm sorry, the larger Southern campaign that comes in 1780. So I haven't had any good book recommendations this week, but when I come back next week, I will definitely have a new book to offer up because the topic we're talking about is probably one of the most important of the Revolution. Also like to give a little shout out to the Philadelphia Eagles. Congratulations on your first Super Bowl. When my New Orleans Saints won in 2009, it was a very big deal. And I know the city of brotherly love is definitely feeling some positive vibes right now. If you live in the Philadelphia area, do not forget tomorrow is parade day. I may try and get out of work and head up there, but can't make any guarantees about that. So everyone have a happy and healthy week, and I'll be back next week. And remember, keep the powder dry.